From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package is likely to be passed without Republicans on board. Early this morning in the Senate, Vice President Kamala Harris cast a tie-breaking vote on a resolution to move it forward. It now goes to the House.
And partisanship was on full display in the House last night. All but 11 Republicans rejected a move by Democrats to take away Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene's committee assignments. Greene has promoted false conspiracy theories about school shootings and the September 11th attacks and called for violence against Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This morning on CBS News, Ocasio-Cortez was asked if she was afraid of working with Taylor Greene.
I would hope that Representative Greene shows some reflection. I will feel safer when she does. But if she doesn't, it remains a very tense situation.
Our Friday roundtable joins us now. Eugene Daniels joins us on his maiden voyage for the Here and Now political roundtable. He is White House correspondent for Politico and author, co-author of the Politico Playbook. Eugene, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on my first time. I'm excited.
And we're glad to have you. Margaret Talev is managing editor at Axios. Margaret, hi.
Hey, great to be with you.
Good to have you. And Margaret, let's start with you. This morning, Marjorie Taylor Greene spoke and said she was freed. Let's listen.
I'm fine with being kicked off of my committees because it'd be a waste of my time. You know who I am. I'm a very hard worker, and I'm proud of it. So now I have a lot of free time on my hands, which means I can talk to a whole lot more people all over this country.
So Congress may have taken her power to legislate away, but they haven't really muted her influence, have they?
This is a really interesting question. I mean, her response tells you everything you need to know about how serious the apology speech the night before was. Not very serious. And so this is someone who has really toggled back between going on the offense, showing herself to be, willing to take on the status quo and especially Democrats and say things that are completely unrooted in fact, but then kind of play the game when it behooves her. I don't know. I got all this bad information. I don't know where it's coming from. And then today you see again the politician she actually is. So, yeah, yes, there is the First Amendment and there are television networks and news outlets that will write about her and the things that she's saying and doing. She has some following. But I think being off those committees will make a difference both in terms of policy and in terms of how tied the Republican Party is to her.
Eugene, a lot of talk about precedent this week. The Democrats have now set themselves up when they're in the minority to have their members stripped of their committee assignments. What do you think about that? Have we reached this new phase of dysfunction that will last for a long time because of this vote?
I feel like every week we're reaching a new level of dysfunction in D.C. And I think that, you know, this is part of it. Nancy, the Speaker of the House, talked about this a little bit yesterday. But to her, she said, no, we will handle our own people. And that's kind of what this vote ended up being, is that Kevin McCarthy kind of him and hawed about, quote unquote, handling Marjorie Taylor Greene himself and doing, you know, having either a conversation, pulling her off of committees himself. And the fact that they didn't, that's why Democrats felt the need to act. If I, you know, I would think, and, you know, Speaker Pelosi says that, you know, if someone from our party is doing something similar, we'll talk to them and get them straightened out. And that's, I think, to Margaret's point, is so key about this, is that leadership is backing her, right? President Trump, though he is not the president, he's still the leader of this party. McCarthy is hugging and embracing her. Most people supported her in this vote. And so she isn't going anywhere and her ideas aren't going anywhere, even though she's isn't on these committees anymore, because leadership has not made her show true contrition, as we saw today.
Eugene, as you say, she still has a lot of support. In this election, she beat her opponent, who was a neurosurgeon. She beat him by a wide margin. So one would think that what she has proclaimed in the past, she might still believe, despite that kind of pseudo-apology. Margaret, are the QAnon conspiracy theories that she says she once believed in, are we seeing a turning point now on the hold that QAnon has over some Americans because of what she said, or not?
Yeah, look, we did some polling this week, and the results were very interesting. We worked with SurveyMonkey, our partners, on this poll, and asked them to talk to Republican and Republican-leaning Americans about whether they're more in line with Marjorie Taylor Greene, more in line with Liz Cheney. And for Republicans in the United States right now, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Kevin McCarthy are much more popular figures with much higher favorability ratings than are either Mitch McConnell or Liz Cheney. It's a snapshot in time. It could change over time as people learn more or as Trump's hold on rhetoric potentially subsides. For right now, it's a superficial knowledge. These are Americans who admit they don't, many of them don't actually know that much about what she believes in or what she stands for, but it is a positive association for them if they identify as Republicans, and that is because of the association with President Trump. So I think all of this, the future of QAnon, the future of Marjorie Taylor Greene, are very much bound up in President Trump's future and potentially, potentially, to some extent, in the future of this $2.7 billion lawsuit brought by one of these voting companies against conservative media and against Fox and against several of these figures, Rudy Giuliani and such and so forth, around defamation. I think as long as there is an outlet, major, major outlets for disinformation and conspiracy theories, that that the QAnon movement will have a foothold in American politics and particularly in the Republican Party.
I think that's,
yeah, and it's hard
I just
to,
want to add quickly to Margaret's point, is that one of the things about Trumpism, because that is a part of the QAnon theory, right? Like President Trump is, and the belief in him is a part of that. It is about Trumpism as a politics of contempt. It's not a politics of a certain policy prescription. It is about the politics of contempt, the politics of being strong and never backing down. And Marjorie Taylor Greene and now Kevin McCarthy are wrapped in that as well. And so until the Republican Party is able to kind of, quote unquote, figure out what they're going to do with President Trump and about his influence in the party, that is still going to be a huge part of the party. And in that slice lies QAnon and more of these conspiracy theorists.
So talking about the rift in the Republican Party, last night, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse denounced his state's Republican Party Central Committee's attempt to censure him because he criticized former President Trump after last month's riot on Capitol Hill. Let's hear from part of that video now.
Politics isn't about the weird worship of one dude. The party could purge Trump skeptics, but I'd like to convince you that not only is that civic cancer for the nation, it's just terrible for our party.
The party will find its way through this by what means, Margaret, because it's not looking that positive right now.
Right. When you're the senator for a state and you have to give a prebuttal to your own party structure, it tells you where we are right now. I mean, look, if you look at the House members who voted, the Republican House members who voted with the Democrats to strip Marjorie Taylor Greene of her assignments, you saw folks who represent swing districts and who represent Florida, New York, and New Jersey, places where she had so deeply offended people with her questions about 9/11 or the Parkland shooting. No one else wants to do that in public on the record. And so this is where Ben Sasse, you know, is at right now. And it's a real conundrum with not an obvious way out. There is no obvious way out right now unless some combination of kind of the zeitgeist of the median Republican voter in the United States and the collective will of party leadership changes. And right now, certainly, I mean, look, Liz Cheney, after everything that happened this week, Liz Cheney herself did not vote to pull Marjorie Taylor Greene off those committees. That tells you everything you need to know.
I do want to move on because there is a lot of action happening on the COVID relief bill overnight in the Senate, for one. But just real quick, before I hope you'll just indulge me on a procedural question here. If you are stripped of all your committee assignments, like what do you do in Congress? Do you just come in for the votes? I mean, she says she can have a lot of time on her hands. What's the job if you're not in committee, yeah, Eugene?
I think doing what she said, right? Like, because the point of these committee hearings is to, or being on committees, is to have influence on the policies that you're pushing forward. And like I said, this Trumpism isn't about policy, right? It is about bluster, and it is about being out there and up front. And she seems to be embracing that. She says she has a lot of time on her hands. She'll be coming in to do votes, but I think she will probably spend most of her time kind of being a briar in the shoe of Kevin McCarthy and other people as they, even though they're, you know, kind of embracing her and kind of at least saying, you know, she can stick around as a member of our party and we want her to be on these committees, that she's going to be bothering them about these kinds of things, like pushing them to be a little bit further right than I think they're comfortable with.
Margaret, we have just about a minute left here, but real quick on the COVID relief bill. Former Clinton Treasury Secretary and Obama Economic Advisor Larry Summers is writing in the Washington Post today that he's concerned Biden's plan is too big and could overheat the economy. We've actually been hearing this from different economists over the last couple of days. Are Democrats heeding those warnings? We just have about 30 seconds now.
Yeah, I actually think Larry Summers' stance speaks for a lot of other Democrats in the party, maybe not the progressive wing, but nevertheless. And here's what we saw in the Voterama and the kind of structure for the reconciliation vote. Two things to keep an eye on. One, the minimum wage is not going to get raised on a force through because of this pandemic. And there is going to be a cap on those $1,400 payments for higher income people. But there's still a lot of other money that there's going to be no effort to restrain.
Margaret Taleb and Eugene Daniels, thanks so much to you both. We're all struggling in some way or another in this pandemic, but some people are experiencing the financial impact of it much more severely than others. A report out from the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland found that 41% of Black-owned businesses closed between February and April of last year. For Latinos, it was 32%, and for White-owned businesses, just 17%. We're going to be speaking now with two small business owners to learn about the special challenges they faced during this crisis, starting with J.P. Lopez, the co-owner of Wonderlust Creamery in Los Angeles, California. J.P., welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And your family has owned this ice cream shop for 5.5 years in L.A. In fact, you've got 5 locations. Tell me a little bit more about your business.
Yeah, so we're an artisanal ice cream shop. All our flavors are inspired by travel. Our first location started off in a small suburb in Los Angeles called Tarzana. Me and my now wife have grown the company to 5 locations, and as of the middle of last year, an online business.
I'm kind of salivating as I look at your menu here. You say your flavors are inspired by travel. Listen to this, sticky rice and mango. All right, that's a good one. Is it ube malted crunch? What's that?
So ube is a sweet purple yam of the Philippines. The flavor was actually a mashup of my wife's favorite flavor from Thrifty's, chocolate malted crunch. Mm-hmm. And to kind of create like a unique flavor, she wanted to mix something of her childhood with also being a Filipino. And so she came up with a ube malted crunch. The idea of Wanderlust came about because all the flavors were based off travel.
It's kind of ironic. The pandemic arrives in spring last year, and nobody's going anywhere. State goes into lockdown. What happened to your business?
You know, from mid-March to about mid-May, I would assume, like, it was pretty slow. You know, we didn't expect anyone to come in. We pretty much went to a shell-like operation where we had maybe one or two people working at a time or even throughout the day. And we switched our entire operation to just pints to go. And we did that for about 2 months while we kind of just were in like a wait and see situation.
So what'd your sales in 2020 look like compared to previous years?
I would say we were probably down about 75% to what we typically would do.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you say you have to adjust, right? I mean, you're in business. You know you have to be flexible. Sounds like you tried to do that by moving to pints to go. How did you figure out what your strategy was going to be when you looked at the numbers and you realized that something had to change?
Well, the pints to go wasn't so much of a business strategy as much it was just we were just trying to do our part to protect our staff. We didn't want to put them in a situation where there were too many customer interactions. And so we started selling pints online as like a test to see if it even worked. And so our plan was, all right, well, let's just kind of make an inventory of pints and we'll announce it on Instagram and via email and we'll see if anyone buys it. And that's kind of how we did. We would do little drops every 2 weeks. You know, the first 2 drops were really successful for us internally. And then it just kind of gave us a little bit of momentum to be able to continue trying to figure out how to more meaningfully handle that online side of things.
Did Did you get any money from the Paycheck Protection Program?
We did.
Well, the reason I ask is because I'm wondering if the government has done what you think it needs to do to help people like you stay in business.
The initial round of PPP loans, it gave us a big boost to be able to bring our entire kitchen staff back. I don't think they've done enough to either warn everyone or just in general to help the situation. It's almost as if they let the restaurant industry out to hang.
Do you plan on going back for round two?
I'm trying. We're trying. At this point, with the uncertainty with COVID, and even though we have vaccines, that uncertainty as to how effective it's really going to be, are there going to be surges in the future that might have to shut us down again? So we're just trying to prepare ourselves for the future, which we have no idea what's going to happen.
Right. How do you plan for that? So how concerned are you about 2021? I mean, where do you see your business going the next 6 to 12 months?
For us internally, I think the way we're planning, just really focus on selling pints online. You know, with the shutdowns in 2020, we used to have a full events team that would do catering. And luckily, we were able to transition that entire staff into our online team. We just started shipping pints online nationwide in mid-December. And that's kind of that's in the one segment of our business that has actually been growing.
Well, good for you. Though I'm sure over the last year or so, you have spent quite a few nights staring at the ceiling, trying to figure out how you're going to get through this. Did you ever come close to just throwing in the towel, saying, nope, it's not going to work?
To be honest, for the first month and a half of the lockdown, we were literally in a position where we were barely breaking even. And my wife and I, we said to each other, we're just going to have to hope that we hit our breaking even number every day. So it was like a really paltry number, and it didn't even matter. As long as we could pay the bills, keep the lights on, we were going to just try and keep things going. And yeah, it was definitely tough in the beginning.
JP, how old are you?
I'm 37.
37. So you probably got a few extra gray hairs by now.
I'm pretty sure I do. I started noticing them a lot over the last few months.
I wonder why. JP Lopez is the co-owner of Wonderlust Creamery in Los Angeles, California. JP, thanks for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we're going to hear from another business owner that wasn't as fortunate as JP, someone who had to make the tough decision to shut down. Mobeen Ahmad was the owner of Shalimar Fine Indian Cuisine in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a family-owned business that opened in 1990, and one local paper described it as the longest-running Indian restaurant in town before it closed in May. Mobeen, welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
And so you say your family is from Pakistan and that you moved to Nashville. I understand with no restaurant experience, and you had three kids and a wife to support. What was that like in the early days to make that big move?
Yeah, because I was working for an airline for 20 years. And it was a good move because I want to raise children in Nashville, Tennessee. I like that place. That's the reason I moved to Nashville. And I had a good up and down, but finally I settled down. I like this job, and I was enjoying this business.
You must have been proud of the business.
Yes. Because my children were growing, and the ethnic people, they had their families paying their mortgages, and they are still in contact with me if I reopen again.
As you say, you had to shut down last year. The losses of the past year in this pandemic were just so terrible, as you know full well. Could you explain the decision that you made to close down? What happened?
Facing the impact of COVID-19 pandemic, cash flow started going negative. All the delivery and groceries moved to credit card payments. So I started feeling that pressure by the mid of March. And the credit card, they have a big high interest rate. There was no mercy on the credit rate side. Mm. And thereafter, I applied in April 1st week for PPP loan, which was extended to me on the mid of May. the last week of May, which was too little too late, and I had to make decision to close it down in last week of May. To avoid any bankruptcy, I paid off all past due payments and other things. So I'm unemployed since 1st of August. So I'm hopeful, God willing, if some help come to me, I'll reopen again.
You know, there's proof that you were very important to this community. You started a GoFundMe campaign, and it looks like your supporters, your customers over the years, responded with over $6,500 in donations. How did that make you feel, getting that kind of response?
Oh, yes, I was so proud, and I was so thankful to them. They still send me gestures through text messages or email, and I'm missing my routine, to be very honest. It was a full-time job. I have many memories and stories with my customers. They love me a lot, and I miss them a lot.
So I can just hear it in your voice how important this business was to you and to your family. How are you dealing with that? How are you getting over the fact that you're not open for business anymore, that you're not with these people who you
love?
It's
very depressing. It's very depressing. I would like to be back to my own routine as soon as I can, God willing.
Yeah, I hope so. But I also wonder what kind of financial position you're in after, you know, the bills piled up so high that you couldn't keep the business open anymore. Are you in a financial position to move forward? I mean, what's your plan?
No, not at all, not at all. I'm just waiting for some help if there is any. But you never know. God is great.
If it weren't for COVID, do you think you'd still be open for business?
Oh, yes.
Mobeen Ahmad was the owner of Shalimar Fine Indian Cuisine in Nashville, Tennessee, last year. He made the decision to permanently shut down the business. Mobeen, thank you for speaking with us. I do hope that 2021 is a little bit better for you than 2020 was. Good luck to you.
Thank you. God bless you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
In Wisconsin, a back-and-forth battle over a mask mandate is creating a whiplash of confusion. Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers issued a new mask mandate. He did it about an hour after the Republican-controlled legislature voted to repeal a previous one. Here's Governor Evers speaking yesterday.
If the legislature keeps playing politics and we don't keep wearing masks, we're going to see more preventable deaths, and it's going to take even longer to get our state and our economy back on track.
Wisconsin lawmakers are back in session today, and as you might guess, they could reverse the governor's mandate. Let's talk more about this with Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Sean, about 550,000 people have tested positive for COVID-19 in Wisconsin as of yesterday, according to the state. Public health experts are unequivocal in their words that wearing masks helps prevent the spread of the coronavirus. So why is the Republican-controlled Senate so adamant on repealing the governor's mask mandate?
I think that as you hear them talk about the mask mandate, they usually cite two things. One, they say they just don't like the idea of a statewide mandate like the one that the governor has, you know, enacted and reenacted in Wisconsin. They don't think it's the government's business to tell people what to do and that people can decide for themselves. They also say it's a rule of law issue, that the governor's acting unilaterally here. He needs to involve the legislature and that he hasn't done that. But I think you also have to look at just fundamentally, there are some members of the legislature, some Republican members, who don't like masks. It's not all Republicans, but you do see some. And so there's some pushback within, you know, the legislature among its members and their constituents who really just don't want the state to be in this business.
And Republicans actually have reason to feel emboldened because the state Supreme Court ruled in their favor last year, and that was to end the governor's stay-at-home order. Are they in a position to keep reversing the governor's mask mandate, which would make one wonder where all of this will end?
They, you know, I think they want to see what the court will do in this case, and they are asking the court to take it up quickly. The court heard arguments, though, in a lawsuit challenging the governor's mask mandate back in November, and it has not ruled yet. So, you know, I guess if you look at that, you would say that for our court, it's not a slam dunk there. I think that the governor and Democrats have a couple things working in their favor. There is a conservative majority on the court, but it's not as big as it was the last time it dealt with a COVID-19 issue like this. And also, this is a new law. The court has not ruled on the specific law that our governor is using to declare the mask mandate. So we don't really know how they're going to rule in this case.
So all of this must be pretty confusing for Wisconsinites, as well as dangerous. Are public health experts concerned about the message this is sending about whether or not to wear a mask?
Yeah, I think the message is key, too. And that seems to be what they're most worried about, because even if this goes away, cities will still be able to issue their own mask mandates. Businesses will still be able to do that. But as the statewide mask mandate goes away, groups like the Wisconsin Medical Society, who will side with Republicans on other issues for sure, are worried about the message that it's going to send. And they say that in places that have enacted mask mandates, mask wearing improves. It goes up. As you take that mandate away, they and other health groups, and there are about 60 that have registered against this move, are worried about what message it's going to send to the public.
Thanks a lot. Sean Johnson at Wisconsin Public Radio.
In Virginia today, lawmakers in the state house voted to abolish the death penalty, and if Governor Ralph Northam signs the bill, Virginia would become the 23rd state to end capital punishment. Whitney Evans is a legal reporter for our member station VPM, and she joins us now from Richmond. And Whitney, what's the latest there in Virginia? Where do things stand with this bill?
Hi, yeah, both chambers have now approved their versions of the bill, but they still have to resolve a disagreement before it can actually go to the governor's desk. And that's whether people who were at one time sentenced to die in Virginia would perhaps be eligible for parole down the road. And the Senate is actually pushing for parole eligibility.
So are they going to have to revote?
They're going to have to go into what's called a conference committee and hash it out. And then they will have to vote.
And then it would go to the governor for his signature. So Democrats are in control of the state legislature in Virginia, and the votes on this bill have been, I think, largely on partisan lines, party lines. But you note that at least a couple of Republicans have shown some support along the way. Why is that newsworthy?
That's right. Well, Democrats, you know, have been wanting to abolish the death penalty for some time, but they didn't have control of the legislature. One Republican, Senator Bill Stanley, actually signed on to co-sponsor this bill, the Senate version of the bill, but he backed out because Senate Democrats wanted to leave the parole provision in. And in the House today, two Republicans joined their Democratic colleagues to vote for the bill.
And what are you hearing from other people who have an interest in keeping the death penalty? Groups supporting victims' families or maybe police advocates, how are they responding?
Right. So law enforcement groups in Virginia support the death penalty. They want to make sure that people can still be sentenced to death, particularly for killing a police officer. The majority of Virginia Republicans, again, say, you know, they also support the death penalty, and they say victims' families deserve what they see as this form of justice. Mind you, I've spoken to numerous family members of victims, not just in Virginia, who say, you know, it only makes healing more difficult and they don't see it as justice at all. I recently spoke to Rachel Sutphin, the daughter of a police officer who was murdered by a man named William Morva in 2006. Morva was executed in 2017 against Sutphin's wishes.
Did we just lose Whitney there? Whitney, are you there? Okay, well, why don't we play that tape? If we're waiting for Whitney to come back here on the line, why don't we play that tape if we have it?
There are many of us, and we have continually spoken out that this is not what we want. However, we do want to honor those who disagree with us. We are not speaking against them, but against this issue that we see as wrong in our society.
Yeah, Sutphin told me that following the whole process leading up to Morva's execution was just really painful.
Yeah. Sorry for the technical difficulties there. Whitney, could you put this into context for us quickly? Virginia has a long history of executing people, but actually hasn't done so in a few years. So what does that mean for people who are still on death row?
Right. There are two people on death row for capital murder. Both men are Black and in their 40s. One of those individuals was convicted of murdering his girlfriend and her two young children. The other was sentenced to death for killing a police officer. So abolishing the death penalty in Virginia would reduce their sentences to life in prison.
All right. Whitney Evans, legal reporter for VPM in Richmond, Virginia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Baltimore is ending its contract with a company that had provided surveillance planes to the police department. The unanimous vote by the city's spending board this week came after a six-month pilot program and after widespread opposition from residents and even city officials. Between May and October last year, Baltimore police used pictures taken by the planes to track the movements of suspected criminals. It was all part of an effort to reduce the city's soaring crime rate, 335 homicides last year alone. Critics warned that people's First and Fourth Amendment rights to privacy and expression were being violated, and the Maryland ACLU filed a lawsuit, which has made its way to the Fourth Circuit Court. To find out more about the program, we want to bring in Emily Sullivan. She is Baltimore City Hall reporter with member station WYPR. Welcome, Emily.
Hey there.
What are Baltimore residents saying about the vote? And tell us what they've been telling you all along about the planes high above their heads.
Sure. So, you know, when I speak to city residents about the program, reactions are mixed. There's certainly animosity. When the planes were active, you could see and hear them. It took them less than 15 minutes to complete their loops over Baltimore. And so whenever the plane was lapping over your home or workplace, you'd hear this droning noise. And this made some people feel like they were under occupation. Ross McNutt, the person behind the technology, he saw similar programs used in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are what inspired him to develop these planes for use in the U.S. On the other hand, some residents supported it because they desperately wanted to see violent crimes go down. For the past 5 years, the city has seen over 300 homicides a year. But the program just didn't produce results that convinced City Hall it was worthwhile.
So you say that they were hoping this would make a dent. What kind of results did it indeed produce?
So reports have suggested that while the planes kept watch over the city, their surveillance caught few criminals. A December analysis from the nonprofit RAND Corporation, it found that a whole host of complicating factors prevented researchers from determining if the surveillance is an effective tool. You know, for example, the plane only flew during daylight hours. So while its footage was used in some homicide cases, researchers stressed that crimes are just much more likely to be solved during the day as it is. And the bulk of the city's homicides occur at night. The same report found that the program provided video evidence for only 10% of the crimes it was supposed to help investigate. And we are waiting on some more analyses, some more reports. But preliminary results just didn't sway the powers that be at City Hall to continue with this program.
Was it impossible for a plane like that if this was the desired effect to fly at night when most of the crimes took place?
The program was privately funded. The tab for the nearly $4 million project was picked up by a private third party, Arnold Ventures. That's a philanthropic group run by John and Laura Arnold. John is a billionaire former Enron trader and hedge fund manager. So the city and the company behind the plane's persistent surveillance system had to come to an agreement about how the planes would be operated, and flying only during daylight hours was part of that agreement.
And the material that was collected by the planes, the evidence, 85% of it has been ordered destroyed, another 15% to be kept by police. What's going to happen to that?
So that 15% of data, that will be used for ongoing criminal investigations. Persistent surveillance system, not the police department, they own the videos and imagery. So under that contract with the city, PSS had to delete unrequested data from the department after 45 days. So the 15% of data, that's data that was requested by the police that will be used for investigations and saved permanently as part of those cases' files.
At this point, the city of St. Louis is considering the same kind of technology, but these Texas philanthropists, Arnold Ventures, you mentioned, have pulled out of funding that pilot program. Do you know why, what the reticence is now?
So the ACLU and other privacy advocates have certainly been waging a campaign against those planes. So after the six-month pilot concluded in Baltimore, the ACLU of Maryland filed a lawsuit against the Baltimore Police Department to stop the program. So even though that program is now effectively terminated, that lawsuit is still ongoing. There will be an appeal heard for it in court next month. And, you know, the hope there, Lisa, the ACLU hopes to stop the program from starting up anywhere else. So there are a good deal of privacy advocates watching and monitoring that lawsuit to see what happens.
So the new mayor of Baltimore, who's been against this plan, has a different strategy to attack crime. What is that?
That's correct. Brandon Scott is the new progressive Democrat mayor here. He was a huge critic of the program back when he was city council president. And this week, after the results of the vote, he said he's working to build a full strategy around proven public safety interventions, not gimmicks like the plane.
Emily Sullivan, Baltimore City Hall reporter with member station WYPR. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
People love diaries and journals. Many of us keep our own, and many more of us have gained insights from reading other people's diaries. Anne Frank's is one of the most widely read books in the world. Journaling has never really gone out of style, and in difficult times like the pandemic, it's possible that more people are keeping diaries or journals to cope with daily life, or even to capture and remember how extraordinary this time has been. So whether it's a pen and paper or an app on your phone, a diary can help you cultivate a regular habit of thoughtfulness and reveal your true self. Micah Hazel has kept a diary since she was 11 years old, and she has this story.
So I keep my diaries in a box under my bed. I've never actually counted them. I have 1, 2, 3...
I have 10 diaries total. They're ratty spiral notebooks covered in stickers like Boss Babe or Girl Power. I even have some video diaries from when I was 15, which are just as mundane as you'd expect.
I loved Taco Bell. Like, I love them. I eat everything they have. When I see a new commercial, I will get it.
Now, I'm 24. But since the beginning of the pandemic, I've been journaling more and more, in writing and on my camcorder.
Okay, so today is August 13, 2020, and there have been reports of like a COVID spike, and it was just kind of a wake-up call to me that I...
Some of my entries are still about daily details, but I've noticed that my diaries have become a lot more emotional over the years.
Hello, it's me. It's November 30th. I am like freaking out about being unemployed. And now I am just in a position where it feels like I am just stuck. There's like no shape in my day. And it sucks.
Besides keeping track of good memories, my diaries have helped me keep track of what I want out of life and who I want to be. And some people who want to focus on those aspects are turning to guided journals, which get you right to those big questions.
Guided journals are more about you and digging deeper inside of you and like your childhood, your thoughts.
This is Mo Sateptim, founder of The Happiness Planner. Her guided journals have prompts like, what's the most courageous thing you've ever done? Or what does success mean to you?
I have friends that have never journaled before. And when they start using, you know, The Happiness Planner or the journals, they're like, it's really scary. I'm too scared to even open the books you gave me.
She says a guided journal is like a practice book that gets us closer to our true self.
It's a tool that basically forces you to reflect more. It's basically like if you want to get more toned and grow muscles and you buy dumbbells and you use it every day, you know, the dumbbell's gonna help you grow some muscles, basically. So I would say that's how, you know, guided journals can help you gain more awareness by being the tools for you to practice with.
Still, the journey to our true self doesn't end with just starting to journal.
Journaling is very therapeutic because it helps you to hopefully grow and accept yourself more.
This is Ryan Hose, therapist and author of the Mental Health Journal for Men.
When someone gets a new journal, oftentimes they start off with a bang. And then the next day, they don't have as much time. And then they feel like, oh, now I'm failing at this and I'm not doing so well. So I actually like to encourage my clients, if they're going to start journaling, to really start small. You know, a few words even of just, what did I feel today? Or what did I notice about myself?
It also means paying attention to your writing style, which can affect what you learned about yourself, says Kate Culkin.
Diaries, I think they really sort of have two functions.
Culkin is a biographer and professor at Bronx Community College.
On the most basic level, they let you know where people were, what they were doing. The other way that they can be used is, how was someone emotionally responding to what was going on in their life?
She's currently working on a book about Ralph Waldo Emerson's daughter, Edith Emerson Forbes.
She had what I thought were going to be very valuable diaries. When I saw them listed in the archives, it was like years of diaries. And when I got them, there was nothing in them. There was nothing emotional in it.
Culkin says that the diaries that get to someone's core are the ones where there's a balance of events and emotions.
The dream diary is, of course, the one where the person records everything that they do and records a thoughtful, emotional response to what happened and how they're processing it.
I admit, rereading my own diaries, I'm not always good at including as much about emotions as about factual details. Still, as Ryan Ho says, getting to know yourself is a continuous journey.
Journaling is a lifelong process where, whether it's daily, whether it's yearly, you just check in with yourself and say, how am I doing right now?
For Here and Now, I'm Micah Hazel.
Micah's story comes to us from WHYY's The Pulse, and now you have something to put on your to-do list this weekend. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.